This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses. Hi, guys, and welcome back to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast. And today we're going to cover another state on the 50 state lien laws and how to file lien properly. And today we are talking about Ohio. And I have an Ohio construction attorney on with me who's going to go into all things, bond claims, liens, all the good things that you need to know as easy as possible to file a lien in Ohio. So, good morning, Andrew. How are you?
I am great. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. This is Andrew Good. He's a construction attorney in Ohio. We'll put all his contact information in the show notes if you want to reach out to him directly if you have an issue in Ohio. But Andrew, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became a construction attorney.
Well, long story short, you know, as an attorney, you sometimes don't get to pick and choose the areas that you practice. And I was fortunate enough to have a few good mentors young that focused on construction law, and I kind of segued into that. I also have some family members that practice in construction, both general contractor and an excavator. They've been doing it for 40 years. So between discussing their issues and problems once I became a lawyer and then having the mentors, it kind of segued into me just focusing in on that and helping out anybody that's really in the trades or GCs or owners and developers.
That's cool, because I really think personally that it's hard to come, and I know this from trying to train lawyers that had no experience in construction, that really takes a special background. And just, what are your observation with judges in construction? Do you find that judges are familiar with the situation, or?
My experience, most judges are not. There are select judges, more so federal court judges, that really undertake and handle the construction cases. I think it's because their past is really open the doors to them to understanding the concepts. But much like any other complex area, it's just something that most judges can't grasp. And so it deals with a lot of hand-holding moving forward, which ultimately, you know, does push people to try to get mediators or go into arbitration to get specialized attorneys that understand the concept and understand the issues and problems. But you know, overall, that's just one of the issues that we have to deal with moving forward.
Yeah, you got to teach them the industry and then teach them the law about the industry. And I find that, you know, because especially when I was first starting out, it's like judges know everything. They should already know all this, how construction works, and they have no idea. And so, you know, I agree with you that arbitration is a good place that you can, you know, get somebody that's familiar with construction. So you have that baseline and you can get it done, at least here, a hell of a lot faster than going to court.
Right. You're spot on with that. And most of the time, you know, whether it's selecting a single arbitrator or, you know, a panel through the AAA, most of the time those arbitrators are experienced construction lawyers that have been doing it for, you know, 30 plus years, and they've kind of hung up their private practice and that's what they're doing full time. So they've seen it all. They've dealt with it all. And it does give an advantage to both parties and either try to push it towards a resolution or have a fair arbitration between the parties. And it's much quicker. You know, we can argue all day about the cost of it, but at the end of the day, if you can get it expedited, the issues resolved quicker, then that's a benefit to everybody.
Yeah, and I know it, from my experience, it costs more up front, but the time you save, like in discovery disputes, all of that protracted litigation that in courtroom, yes, it costs more up front, but in the long run, your client saves money and you can get it decided, which is such a breath of fresh air comparative, at least the courts here. We were backed up by Harvey and then COVID hit. And so it's hard to get a decision down.
Yeah. Yeah. In Ohio, we're looking at, for civil cases, you know, courts are pushing them out again another year at least. I was supposed to have an arbitration in 2 weeks, and that's been kicked to basically a year from now. Everything's been done on it. But you know, we're basically going to sit here and wait. And obviously that's just going to cost more time, you know, to get back up to speed in a year, meet with the clients, go through all the documents again. So there are distinct benefits to going into arbitration.
I agree. Okay. So I know that was a little sidebar, but I think it's important to get the perspective from everybody that's in the same industry. So first question, do contractors have to be licensed to perform work in Ohio?
So if they're going to be practicing in certain trades, so HVAC, electricity, plumbing, hydronics, and refrigeration, you have to be licensed by the state of Ohio. But most of the time, really, it's going to be by locale, by municipality. Each municipality in Ohio has their own requirements. A lot of them do mirror what Ohio State requires. Some of them are less stringent on what the application and licensing process means. There's a difference between residential and commercial. Residential, there's different types of costs, whether or not the project's going to be, I think one of them is $1,000. If you're doing just remodeling stuff under $1,000, you don't need something. But other and above that, most of the municipalities in here do require you to be licensed or get licensed, at least through the local or through the state.
Gotcha. Before you do any work. Okay, so in Ohio, well, let's start with the private projects. Who has lien rights in Ohio? Who can lien a project?
So anybody that is providing labor or work on the job site or furnishing materials to the project. And, you know, furnishing materials, we can talk about it later. But Ohio is pretty fair in terms of what material men can do in terms of lien rights. We're pushing, and there is some push to try to get lien rights to engineers and architects. Right now, it's kind of a mix. Some people say you can't have lien rights, but there is a case law basically saying that if that engineer or architect was providing on-site work in furtherance of improvement, then they have lien rights. And that hasn't been exposed yet, it hasn't been pushed, but other than that, it's generally everybody that's working on the site.
Gotcha. So potentially, if you're an architect or engineer that doesn't do any boots on the ground work, that you couldn't have lien rights.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So notice requirements. So if I'm hired directly by the owner, is there any notice requirements I have to send before I file a lien or anything like that?
No. If you're in direct privy of contract with the owner, there is no requirement to do what in Ohio is called a notice of furnishing. That's really limited to the subcontractors, material suppliers, or laborers. But for the GCs, no.
Okay, so for that GC section, for that place one contractor, when do they need to file their liens by? Does it matter on project type, or is it the same universally? Or
so residential, it's going to be 60 days from the date of the last labor or work performed or materials furnished. And then for commercial, it's 75 days. And then it's 120 days on public improvement projects.
Gotcha. And so after you file the lien, do you need to send the notice to the owner, the copy of the lien that was filed to the owner? And what is the time frame to do that in?
Yeah, so it's within 30 days of you recording. That's the key, is you don't want to send the affidavit prior to him being recorded. You want to have an actual stamped recorded by the recorder's office for the locale where the project is. It has to be within 30 days. You serve it on them. It could be based on who's identified in the notice of commencement, which is generally what the owner has to record. And the only requirement is the owner, part owner, or leasehold interest for the property you're working on.
Okay, so there's a notice of commencement on projects over what size? Or is there a, is for all projects, or is there a...
Yeah, so for any commercial project, you're required to do a notice of commencements, and that has to be recorded by the owner. And then there's a whole multitude of scenarios that's outlined in the Ohio Revised Code. Basically, it's supposed to be recorded prior to any labor or work performed on the site. If it's not, then generally the general contractor or a subcontractor or material supplier can request a copy of that. And if the owner does not record it, then essentially your lien rights are preserved until you receive a copy of that notice of commencement. And then you have 21 days to file a notice of furnishing from that point.
From the time that you get the notice of commencement.
Correct.
If it's not filed.
Correct. Okay. And one of the key things I think everybody should be aware of is don't expect, if you're a subcontractor or a material supplier, don't expect an owner or GC just to provide you with a notice of commencement. If it's been recorded, There is no duty just to come out and give it to you. It's only a duty if you've requested it. And so prior to performing any labor or supplying any materials, you should really just search the recorder's office to see if one is there. Because then if it's not recorded, then you know your lien rights have been preserved. You can request one and move forward that way. We see a lot of issues with that where subcontractors will come and they didn't know a notice of commencement was recorded. They provided the work, and all of a sudden they are scrambling. They file their notice of furnishing. And if they do that, obviously, once you file your notice of furnishing, it's only preserving really the work and materials that you supplied for 21 days prior to that. So it's a key thing that everybody needs to be aware of.
Gotcha. So for place two, which is our subcontractors, they need to send, do they need to send or do they need to file a notice of furnishing?
They just need to serve it. That's it.
Okay.
So
on the owner and the general, or just the owner?
It's just on the owner, but a good rule of thumb is to serve it on both. Gotcha. And generally what I do is any person that's really identified in the notice of commencement, I'm going to put them on notice of furnishing. You know, some people get a little eerie about serving lenders or financial institutions. However, that could be looking at case-by-case situation. That could be a bullet in your chamber, so to say, to strong arm them to pay you because the lender may have provisions to cut the project short or, you know, foreclose on the property themselves if there's a lien that's going to be filed.
Absolutely. And a lien is all about creating leverage to get paid.
Correct.
And so how hard do you want to push? It's another tool that you can use.
Right.
So the notice of furnishing needs to be sent within 21 days of first work?
Yeah. So within 21 days of the first day that you provided labor or furnished materials to the project. Yes.
Gotcha. Okay, and is that sent certified mail? What are the notice requirements in Ohio?
Yeah, so generally, if it's a corporation, there's a specific statute that says, you know, you're supposed to be serving the statutory agent or the agent that is represented by the company. And so typically in the notice of commencement, they're going to be identifying the agent and the owner. And you can look up under the Secretary of State who the agent is. I generally try to serve both the entity and the agent represented on the notice of commencement, and if it's different, whoever the agent is identified by the Secretary of State, because then you're kind of crossing your T's and dotting your I's.
Double cover. So does it matter, like, certified mail, or can I email it? Does it matter the method that it gets
it's
there?
It's certified mail, return receipt. There's also, it could be sheriff service, and generally with the corporations in most commercial projects or, you know, the public entity, it's going to outline that in your contract. But for Ohio, I always stick with certified mail or FedEx with return receipt signature required, because then you've confirmed it. Without that, you're really not able to confirm that it's been served.
Gotcha. So does it actually have to be received to be effective, or can it just be sent and they never pick it up? Is it still effective?
It has to be actually served on them. So that's why if you know, unfortunately, the unfortunate reality is a lot of times people will put P.O. boxes. And so if you're serving that and somebody's not coming down to the post office to get that, or they just, you know, disclaim it and it's, unable to return, after 30 days of your attempted, right, because you have to serve them within 30 days, if you can't do that, you have an additional 10 days. And what you have to do there is you have to take the notice and basically post it. And let me take a step back, because I think we're getting ahead. For the notice of furnishing, it just needs to be served. Okay. And we'll go into the affidavit for the 30 days. But the notice of furnishing can just be served if most of the time in the contracts in Ohio that I've seen, the notice of furnishing, they'll outline it specifically who the authorized agent is, who can be served by. And it also may give you an additional ability to serve that notice of furnishing by email on an owner's rep or the contractor. So paying attention to the contract and those terms can also help you out, because if the contract allows you to do that, then you're good by Ohio law.
Okay, cool. Could they allow that in the notice of commencement too, or no?
No.
If they put...
Yeah, okay, the notice of commencement has to be recorded, and then it has to be provided. Basically, once the notice of commencement is recorded, right, it's up to the GC to get a copy of that, and then it's up to the subs and material suppliers to request that if it's not been provided to them. You know, it's supposed to also be published and on the job site. So that's another area you can ask, hey, is a notice commencement published anywhere on the site? And then you can get a copy of that.
Okay, so for subcontractors and then material suppliers, they both have that same 21 days from first furnishing and first labor that got to send a notice out.
That's correct.
Okay, so then for a subcontractor, when do they have to file their lien by? We're talking somebody who was hired directly by the GC.
So for a subcontractor or material supplier, it's 60 days on a residential project or 75 days from the date of the last labor or materials furnished on the project. Okay. And that's generally how it is. It's not extended at all, and there's always arguments in terms of the date. So documentation is key.
Absolutely. And it's the last work out there, substantial work, or would a punch through count, or would warranty work count?
And so, and this is where Ohio kind of looks at it differently, right? They've generally said punchless work is not considered, but the really is, are you performing work in terms of improving the project? So if you're going back and you're redoing, you know, if you're an electrician and you're redoing some electric or you're redoing, you know, wires, my argument is that's absolutely on it. There's been cases where they've gone just to pick up equipment and mm-hmm. they've found that to be providing improvement because they were cleaning up the job site. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's local level, but, you know, it hasn't been pushed to the Court of Appeals.
It works. Yeah. Awesome. That still works. Okay. And so once you file your lien, okay, for subcontractors and material suppliers at that timeline, how long do they have to send the copy of the notice, and who do they have to send it to? A copy of the lien that was filed, and who do they have to send it to?
All right. So a copy of the affidavit, once you file your affidavit for mechanics lien in Ohio, you have 30 days to serve it, and you have to serve it on the owner, part owner, or leasehold interest. And this is where it has to be served on them. If you can't get service by the methods that we previously talked about, then you have 10 days to post it in a non-conspicuous place. So basically where all the permitting and things like that are on the project site would be a good place to post it. And at that point, you've made good service.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. So once your lien has been filed, you sent notice, it's properly perfected. How long is it good for?
It's good for 6 years. So,
really?
Yeah. So you have 6 years lien unless a notice to commence suit is sent to you. Then obviously you're going to be disputing the validity of the lien, but otherwise it's 6 years.
Cool. Very cool. All right. And so if you have to file suit to enforce your lien, can you get back your attorney's fees?
Yes. So there's two ways, right? One, you hope the contract provisions has that language in it, especially in Ohio, because Ohio follows the American rule, which basically says the contract language governs for attorney's fees. But under, I believe it's Revised Code Section 13.11.16, it does allow recovery for your attorney's fees, but in a specific scenario. And it's basically when they say there's a fund, and what a fund has been deemed as is a bond. So if a lien has been bonded off, then you can seek your attorney's fees. And obviously there's always the, you know, possibility that a court can award attorney fees based on the claims and the actions of the opposing party. Very limited situation, but we've seen recent success in the last 5 years of people getting those awarded based on egregious nature, delay tactics, not paying them timely or withholding, you know, try to strong arm subs and material suppliers to reduce their costs.
Gotcha. So it's not just filing an enforcement or foreclosure that would entitle you to your fees automatically.
No.
Gotcha. It's a more limited situation, and which is why they would take advantage of that and, you know, wait you out the 6 years.
Right. Exactly.
How much is money worth 6 years later?
Exactly. I mean, and, you know, what we see a lot in Ohio is, you know, these developers are building big buildings, and then they, you know, with the intent to turn around and sell it. And so, you know, while a lien may just sit there, you know, if they have an intent to, you know, try to sell it, they have to get that lien removed. So bonding it off is a good surety, and then you can take the next steps if necessary to file a lien to foreclose on that bond.
Okay, cool. Very cool. All right, so back to incorporation for material suppliers. Always a big question I get because it's different in all 50 states. You know, does the material supplier actually have to prove that it's incorporated? Can they just deliver it? Can their contractor pick it up? What is your level of, what do we have to prove in Ohio?
So In Ohio, for material suppliers, there's actually a specific section for material suppliers. It's 13.11.12, I believe it is. And it outlines, I think, five scenarios. One, obviously, is with the intent that the materials are incorporated or used in the project. And that's really all you have to show is there's a contract for sale, a delivery order, or delivery to the site. And that gives you the conclusive, and what the revised code section specifically says is there's a conclusive presumption that those materials, if any one of those things are met, that those are going to be used and incorporated into the improvement. And so it's an easy, in my opinion, burden for a material supplier to hit that without having the lien refuted if you can show a contract or delivery order or actually delivery to the site. Delivery to the site is going to clearly be a presumptive, a conclusive presumption that it's going to be incorporated if you have those two other things as well. Obviously, if it's incorporated in the project, then it's done. For specifically fabricated materials, what it says is specifically fabricated for incorporation. Now, whether or not that doesn't matter if they're incorporated or not, it has to basically be unique to the project, and that material supplier can't take those goods and resell them to another project. So if you have that, then you have lien rights.
So let's go in the especially fabricated. So the stuff is never delivered. When do I have to send my notices?
So this is where Ohio gets kind of tricky, right? Because the law specifically says, you know, in terms of lien rights, is when it's furnished, right? When it's delivered to the site or provided. And that's effectively what the Ohio Revised Code is putting in an example of the, you know, notice of furnishing. You're supposed to give the date of when it either is intended to be furnished or when it's going to be furnished. So, you know, if it's never delivered, right, you want to make sure if there's a date on the contract or the delivery schedule that it's giving you a date, because then you have those lien rights obviously memorialized in the thing. If it's not there, right, there has been case law that shows that if the material supplier delivers it to the site, they can put delivered or intend to deliver within 10 days. I'm going through an issue with that right now with the material supplier. It's been delayed, and their subs, you know, are getting frustrated because they're not getting paid and they're going to lien it. And so, you know, it's got to be communication with the GC or whoever you're contracted with. But, you know, you can always, if you have the contract, they've, you know, intended to purchase them, you've made them, they're sitting there, you know, then you can inform the contractor, hey, I'm going to be delivering, contractor for these are going to be delivered. Where do I need to put them? Put that in your notice of furnishing. And get them delivered to the site. If they're refused, then at least you have that intent. You preserve your lien rights by the notice of furnishing.
Gotcha, because you tried to do it.
Right, right. Okay. And even after the fact, you know, I would still, you know, if they're not delivered, right, there's a little bit of case law out there that talks about whether or not they're delivered or undelivered. And it still provides you, once they're specifically fabricated, if they're sitting there, to allow you to lien right it. It's just how the notice of furnishing is going to be worded to make sure that you're preserving that.
Gotcha. Okay, good to know. All right. And the construction lender involved in the lien process, you said a little bit, basically based on their agreement with the owner?
Right. So how Revised Code says is you have the option to serve the lender, but it's not a requirement. The only requirement is serving the owner, part owner, or leasehold interest. And that's it. Strategically, gotcha. I think depending on the relationship, if you know it's a contractor you're not going to be doing business with ever again based on the experience, and you want to stronghold them, then you know it could be a good idea to serve everybody. You just want to kind of weigh your pros and cons and probably talk mm-hmm. with your attorney to determine if that's the best avenue and whether or not the contract says you can or can't do that.
Gotcha. Okay, lease spaces. Can you have a lien on a lease space?
You can. So Ohio allows it for filing for the owner, part owner, or leasehold interest. So for instance, I can give you an example. We had a GC that was providing work for a grocer. The grocer was leasing a space in a strip mall, and we filed a lien strictly on the leasehold interest. One thing you kind of got to be leery of is in the language of your affidavit, you want to either limit it to strictly moving for the leasehold interest, or it doesn't matter, you can keep owner, part owner, or leasehold interest in that. However, if the owner or part owner comes back and says, hey, I'm having issues, you kind of want to be leery on that. You want to get confirmation that they have no interest in the leasehold interest, they don't care about it, get that in writing, and then you can file a release of the lien on the fee simple interest, the ownership interest only, and that'll secure it.
Gotcha. Okay. They're kind of the same thing here. We are allowed to have a lien on the fee on the whole thing if the owner was somehow paying for the improvements. So,
Correct. And there's and people, I think defense attorneys and attorneys suing have gotten really creative on this. It's, you know, if the owner is leasing the space and they're aware of the improvements mm-hmm. being done, you can make an argument that they still are bound by it. If they're disclaiming any interest in it, and you have that in writing, it's just going to be kind of weighing the pros and cons as to whether or not you want to bring them in there. Sometimes, again, that can be strategy for putting pressure on that leasehold interest to pay you.
Absolutely. Okay, so I did a little research on Ohio, and you have some, for a public project, you actually have two different ways to preserve your money. The first is like same in every state and federal, it's just the bond. So if I'm working on a bond claim, if I'm working on a state of Ohio project, what do I have to do to preserve my bond claim rights as a sub or material supplier?
So it's very similar to on private projects. It mirrors it, right? You have to do within 21 days of the furnishing of first material or labor, provide a notice of furnishing to the owner. So to the city or to the entity of the state, indicating that you're doing that. Then you preserve it. And then within, I think it's 120 days of the last date of labor, you're serving that affidavit for the claim on, contested or public funds. And you're going to want to put the GC on notice as well with that. But that's really it. It fairly mimics and mirrors the private side, but there's some little nuances in terms of differences, but not very much.
So you can also have a lien on the funds that are due to the prime contractor before they're paid.
Correct. Yeah. So that's generally how it works out. Is the lien is filed. It's going to be on the funds, and that's going to be up to the contract total amount.
Okay.
And then the GC will likely bond that off. And they have to bond that off at well above 1.5 times the amount being claimed. And then from there, the public funds are released and you're basically going on the bond.
Gotcha. Okay. So what if by the time you send notice, they've paid the contractor everything? Do you still have a lien, or do you only have a lien to the extent that there's money owed to the prime contractor?
Well, no, you would still have a lien you'd have multiple. You'd have a lien, you probably have a prompt payment act, because if the contractor's been paid for the work materials that you've supplied and they haven't paid you yet, but you would still have a lien, and obviously the city or the state is going to say, hey, we've paid all the amounts out, but still it's going to have to be bonded off, because all state and public proven projects have a requirement for that. They have performance bid bonds and payment bonds. So that's going to kick in. Their bond is going to come forward, and they're going to put forth a bond over whatever claim to make sure that the project is free and clear of any liens.
Gotcha. Because technically you can't lien a public
project.
Correct.
You can
only
lien the basically taxpayer dollars. That fund for the project that's approved by the city council or the state.
So do you ever have to send notice to a surety at all?
If there's a bond on the project, right? Mm-hmm. Which for any public improvement project with the state of Ohio, there's going to be, prior to filing, any type of lien on that, it probably makes sense to, put the GC on notice. And if you have a copy of the bond, send a claim to the surety bond company and then monitor that. So because obviously surety bond companies take 30 to 60 days to review everything to make sure, and then after that they'll bond it off. But you want to kind of take two different routes. If you're aware of there's a bond, you have a copy of the bond, go after that way. If you're not going to get paid by the timeline that you have to file the lien, then you move forward with the lien. Most likely, in both those scenarios, it's all going to come to a head at one point. And hopefully by that point, when the lien comes in, the surety bond company has put up the bond, provided notice to either the state or the city, and that gets approved by the state or the city, and then now you're just really suing on the bond by the surety company, and you work it out.
So just because I'm curious, if you have to file suit on the surety, does the general contractor still step in and defend because it's their bond, or are you purely just going against the surety?
So it's both. I've seen where it's both, where the surety bond company is pushing back on the GC, saying, GC, you're at fault. And GC is saying, no, I'm not at fault. And I've also seen it where the surety has tendered the defense to the GC based upon the surety provisions. That's the latter is the more likely situation, at least in Ohio. But it's happened both ways.
Because it's more like, The surety's like, GC, you take care of it. If there's a judgment against us, we'll write the check. But if they have to spend any money, they're coming after whoever's bond it is to be taken care of. So,
right. Yeah, you're right on that. Most of the time, once that bond is there, but I think some of the construction attorneys in Ohio have seen through that because at the end of the day, once all the evidence comes out, the surety can always say, oh, you did something completely wrong, or if there was a fraud claim or anything like that, that wouldn't be covered by a bond. They're looking at that. So most people are starting to sue both just to keep them in. And obviously if there's that bond, you want to, kind of assure that surety is going to be paying you by the end of the day. And that's how you kind of keep them in the lawsuit.
Gotcha. I appreciate all this awesome information. Now tell me your favorite construction law story for a client, how you helped a client win. Something that construction law attorneys will nerd out on,
Yeah. I mean, we've had, I can tell you there's a lot, right? There's good, bad horror stories. But I'd probably have to say, we had a general contractor we were representing. They had a great relationship. They're a specialty niche contractor. They do refrigeration. And they basically got contracted for five locations to redo it. I retrofit it. They basically became the GC for it, even though they were really only doing the HVAC and plumbing for the refrigeration stuff and massive grocery stores. But big money came out to be an issue. I think it went 4.5 years. And finally, the court came out and was favorable to the clients. That was probably the best just because it was long drawn out, headache. And at the end of the day, you're kind of sitting there sweating bullets as the attorney going, this has been 4.5 years. You've paid me how much money?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Exactly.
But if I had to say alternative, I represented a homeowner against a unlicensed general contractor that flipped a house there. And I'm sure everybody is aware there's GCs that are unlicensed that are doing these house flips and they do them very fraudulently. And the homeowners were able to get their money back and get the house back up to shape. And there was all kinds of hidden mold and bees nests and carpenter ants and everything like that. So that's kind of the heartfelt one.
Yeah. Gotcha.
And the business one, sweat and bullets.
It's awesome. And especially when you love what you do, it's never boring, right?
Right. You see it all. You see it
exactly.
All.
Exactly. So, from angry homeowners to, collecting material suppliers' money, it's all rewarding.
So. Yeah. And it's all unique. And with all the technology and the materials being, evolving and the differences, it's getting really interesting. And I'm always learning. Always.
Now, let me ask you one more question. This is kind of because I'm on a mission. What do you think about subcontracts?
My father-in-law would say a handshake's good enough since he is a subcontractor. I think there's kind of two ways to look at this, right? As a subcontractor, you're kind of, beholden to the GC, right? You work for a lot of big GCs. GCs are going to say, here's our contract. That's it. There's nothing changed, right? That's a problem. you know, but if there's an opportunity for subcontracts to be modified and made favorable or at least reasonable to the subcontractor, I'm absolutely all for it, because subcontractors and material suppliers do get the, you know, wrong end of the stick a lot of times, and then they're kind of left with their hands in their pockets when, you know, it could have been protected up front if they would have reviewed that. And it could just be simply as modifying your purchase order or anything else, just to have those key terms and provisions in there. But, you know, I suggest now in the nature, especially in Ohio, with contract law being kind of the final say and the final word, that, you know, you need to take a look at them and you need to make sure you're protected.
Well, exactly. I mean, because I'm really, I think what's happened over the years is that attorneys have done a good job drafting something that would protect their client, thinking that there was going to be a negotiation. And then with the subcontractors, there just never was. And so now we've gotten these massive things that are all basically shit rolls downhill, right? And now we have the little guy taking 100% of the risk. And don't be wrong, he doesn't know that he's taking 100% because he can't even read it.
Right.
It just, okay, even if you're going to put all this shit in there, let's just make it so you could read it, because
yeah,
it takes me, a lawyer, like four times of reading it to try to say what we're trying to say. Just put it.
Right. Anyway. Yeah. I mean, I just had, it was a 129 page contract for
what?
Electrical subcontractor.
And what? Okay. Yeah. Sorry. From your opinion, what could we have done that in 10 pages?
And just 100%. And I mean, I'd probably mark 20 times redundant, and it was all those redundancies were, you will not sue the contractor. You can't sue the contractor. There's nothing you can do against us. You know, you can't file a lien. You can't do this. You're going to waive all your rights. I mean, repetitive. And I mean, it could have been dumbed down to 10 pages. Exactly.
If you want to, you can make it whatever you want. Let's make it simple and easy to read.
Right. Right. And the other thing is that, when I tell, you know, some of the general contractors that we represent is, look, just make it reasonable. Because if you're going to make it reasonable, you're going to protect them. And, you know, they're going to do better work for you, and they're going to want to continue working for you. And if they're good at what they do, then now you have a relationship developed. But, you know, on the flip side is, if you're not doing that and you're a really good subcontractor, you're probably not going to want to do business with that. And then you're going to go to another GC that's willing to work with you and protect you and do the right things. And that's going to create better competition for the subs. But you know, that's just, it's unfortunate, but that's the way of the world right now.
Absolutely. And I'm really on a push to just, even if we as attorneys just review it and tell the subs what's in there. And I'm not all for making it all one sub-sided. Let's make something in the middle, like I think it used to be.
Right.
So, until we, I don't know how we ended up in this mess where if you're going to be a subcontractor, you just might as well hold your nose and sign it and hope that you'll make it through it, because that's not a way to conduct business. And especially because I think a contract is supposed to tell you what you're supposed to do, but if you can't understand it, how do you know what you're supposed to do?
Right. I agree with you, you know, and that's kind of the one thing, I'm sure you do it. I mean, when I'm going through them, I mean, I'm highlighting and putting box in, you know, be aware of this, you know, especially on a lot of the claim provisions, because in Ohio, the claim provisions, I mean, they're upheld. If you're not doing it strictly by the book, then you can basically be held to have waived that claim. A colleague of mine had a case where, I mean, they submitted, I think it was like 36 claims constantly, doing it exactly with the contract. The contractor came back and said, quit submitting this. We get it. We know you're doing this. You don't need to submit them anymore. And they stopped. And every single claim after that, they were found by the court to have waived because they didn't follow the contract provisions. And so, you know, if a sub's not, reading that until when necessary, that's the problem. So, you know, it's a lot of, you know, yellow highlighting and, you know, text boxes to make sure everybody's aware of it. And then, you know, subsequent to that, we can go through it through a quick, you know, Zoom call or something like that to say, hey, here's the real big things that you need to be aware of. And here's what we really should change. And if they're not going to change it, here's how it could play out. And at least let them make it. But no, a lot, it's majority of the time, as you know, it's after the fact, right? You know, call me now or call me later. You're going to be calling me at some point.
No, exactly.
And, you know, that's the unfortunate reality for subs and material suppliers.
No, I know. Yeah, I don't know. I'm on a mission to change that. But, oh, one other question. For Ohio specifically, can you pre-waive your lien rights in a contract? Some states allow it, some states don't.
No, you cannot.
Okay. Because I know in New York you can, but Texas you can't.
You cannot, yeah. Ohio does not allow that.
Awesome. Well, thank you for all the great information, and we'll put your contact information in the show notes so somebody can contact if you want to reach out. This is just part of the project that I'm working on of making subcontracts understandable and somewhat fair, and letting people know that they're lien rights and that they have these rights and they can secure the amount that they're owed, but they have to do it the right way.
No, so absolutely fantastic. I think this is a great project, and you know, looking forward to probably listening on a few others for states that I have no idea about. So
absolutely. And like I said, Texas is so complex, it just required its whole own book. And I've kind of studied all 50 states, and so I kind of have a, you know, a perspective on it. But, you know, once you've been in it so long, it's kind of the same. So, all right, Andrew, thank you so much. We'll probably have you on again to talk about something else exciting, like more how we can change subcontract terms, maybe the pay when paid clause or fun things like that.
Oh, yeah. Force majeure, all right. Force majeure clauses. We could talk all day about
that. Oh, absolutely. Since COVID, especially.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Andrew.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Tune in 2 weeks from now for a new episode. Thank you.